This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may live upon the earth, and certainly valuable for all people, because there is no greater threat to the peace and stability of the world than the threat coming from Jewish supremacism. And we're seeing the teeth and the fangs of Jewish supremacism right now, and the horrible destruction and bloodletting going on in Lebanon and Gaza and other places in the Middle East. They're trying to make it a wider war. They're securing the realm, as written by Richard Pearl and Wormser and other Jewish supremacists from the United States, and they're living it out now. So it's a terrible time, but I hope you'll find a lot of understanding from this spoken word version of Jewish supremacism. Again, this is part 3 of the chapter, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism, chapter 2 of my book, Jewish Supremacism. And again, don't forget, the footnotes and sources are all available in the edition of the book that you can order directly from our office and directly from www.davidduke.com. The next section is Zionism as Racism. After 2,000 years of conflict, the Jewish prayer next year in Jerusalem has finally become expressed in an open political movement called Zionism. In 1862, Moses Hess, the teacher of Karl Marx and the spiritual father of both Zionism and Communism, wrote Rome and Jerusalem. In it, he expressed the familiar Talmudic values. We Jews shall always remain strangers among the Goyim, Gentiles. It is a fact. The Jewish religion is above all Jewish nationalism. Each and every Jew, whether or not he wishes it, is automatically, by virtue of his birth, bound in solidarity with his entire nation. One must be a Jew first and a human being second. If Adolf Hitler had ever said the words, one must be a German first and human being second, would not those words be repeated often as proof of his depravity? For some compelling reason, no one dares to condemn such words when they come from the important Jewish leader who laid the foundations of both Zionism and Communism. I began to survey Zionist literature, from the writings of Moses Hess to the present day, and repeatedly I encountered the same supremacism expressed in the Talmud. A prominent Zionist historian, Simon Dubnow, wrote The Foundation of National Judaism in 1906. In it, he expressed sentiments that would certainly be described as anti-Semitic had they come from a Gentile. Quote, assimilation is common treason against the banner and ideals of the Jewish people, but one can never become a member of a national group such as a family, a tribe, a nation. A Jew, on the other hand, even if he happened to be born in France and still lives there, in spite of all this, he remains a member of the Jewish nation, and whether he likes it or not, whether he's aware of it or unaware of it, he bears the seal of the historic evolution of the Jewish nation. In 1965, Moshe Menuhin, an Israeli who was born into an extremely prominent Hasidic family, dared to write an expose of Jewish hypocrisy. He wrote a fascinating book called The Decadence of Judaism. He was a graduate of the yeshiva in Jerusalem and was the father of the prominent Israeli musical performer Yehudi Menuhin. Menuhin documents the influential modern Zionist writer Jacob Klatskin addressing the world at large in his 1921 German-language book Crisis and Entscheidung, Crisis and Decision. Klatskin writes, we are not hyphenated Jews. We are Jews with no qualifications or reservations. We are simply aliens. We are a foreign people in your midst, and we emphasize we wish to stay that way. There is a wide gap between you and us, so wide that no bridge can be laid across. Your spirit is alien to us. Your myths, legends, habits, customs, traditions, and national heritage, your religious and national shrines, your Sundays and holidays, they are all alien to us. The history of your triumphs and defeats, your war songs and battle hymns, your heroes and their mighty deeds, Your national ambitions and aspirations, they're all alien to us. The boundaries of your lands cannot restrict our movements, and your border clashes are not of our concern. Far over and above the frontiers and boundaries of your land stand our Jewish unity. Whosoever calls the foreign Gentile land a fatherland is a traitor to the Jewish people. A loyal Jew can never be other than a Jewish patriot. We recognize a national unity of the diaspora Jews, no matter in which country they may reside. Therefore, no boundaries can restrain us in pursuing our own Jewish policy. And ladies and gentlemen, as a side note, they're doing that, of course, today. They pursue that policy in the Iraq War, in the Middle East, and they're controlling our country in so many ways. Before the Second World War, Noam Goldman, president of the World Zionist Organization, urged German Jews to immigrate to Palestine using the following blunt words. Judaism can have nothing in common with Germanism. If we go by the standards of race, history, and culture, and the Germans do have the right to prevent Jews from intruding on the affairs of their folk, the same demand I raise for the Jewish folk as against the German. The Jews are divided into two categories, those who admit they belong to a race distinguished by a history thousands of years old, and those who don't. The latter are open to the charge of dishonesty. Even Judge Louis Brandeis, the Zionist who sat on the American Supreme Court, said it succinctly, Jews are a distinct nationality. Whatever his country, his station, or his shade of belief, he is necessarily a member. Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, expresses the true causes of what he calls the Jewish question. This is Theodor Herzl. Again, this is the father of Zionism. The Jewish question exists whenever Jews are to be found in large numbers. Every nation in whose midst Jews live is either covertly or openly anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism increases day by day and hour by hour among the nations. Indeed, it is bound to increase because the causes of its growth continue to exist and cannot be removed. Its immediate causes are excessive production of mediocre intellects who cannot find an outlet downwards or upwards. That is to say, no wholesome outlet in either direction. When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of all revolutionary parties. At the same time when we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse. Unquote. The Jews' exclusivity, their resistance to assimilation, their alien traditions and customs, their often questionable economic practices, and their carefully nurtured hateful attitude toward other peoples and religions, all these factors have contributed to a reaction from the Christian world that at times became extreme. With each persecution the Jews suffered, their own distrust and antipathy toward Gentiles became intensified in their own writings and in patterns of behavior that engendered still more persecution. A cycle of recrimination began that still continues as we embark on the early years of the 21st century. A whole generation of Jews is now growing up inundated with stories of Gentile perfidy. Not only are the Germans and the Eastern Europeans blamed for the Holocaust, but now there are many Jewish-authored books arguing that all the Western nations share in the guilt, as well as President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Catholic Church, and indeed the entire Christian world. I discovered that to draw attention to the writings of the Talmud and to quote the very words used by modern Jewish leaders and writers invites the charge of anti-Semitism. It seemed to me that if repeating the words of Jewish leaders is anti-Semitism, then there must be distasteful elements in the words themselves. Maybe one should consider the historical Jewish attitude toward Gentiles pertinent to assessing the causes of anti-Semitism. Bernard, a popular Jewish intellectual in France in the 19th century, investigated his people's role in the age-old conflict with other peoples. In the widely circulated book, L'Antisemitisme, he wrote, if this hostility, this repugnance, had been shown toward the Jews at one time or in one country only, it would be easy to account for the local causes of this sentiment. But this race has been the object of hatred with all the nations amidst whom it's ever settled. Inasmuch as the enemies of the Jews belong to diverse races, it must be that the general causes of anti-Semitism have always resided in Israel itself and not in those who antagonized it. Unquote. Some might argue that the anti-Gentile tone of the Talmud in the founding Zionists has little relevance to the Jews of today. The evidence, however, is that the core of Judaism, Orthodoxy, is steadily becoming more, rather than less, more extreme against Gentiles than in previous generations. The Encyclopedia Judaica says as much in its article on the subject. Perhaps this development could have been predicted with the advent of modern film. Cinema and television wield an enormous influence on human emotions. Jewish producers create endless accounts of the persecutions of Jews, all the way from the Torah to the Holocaust. Thousands of well-crafted films, from the Ten Commandments to Schindler's List, graphically remind Jews of Gentile perfidy while softening Gentiles to Jewish causes. The incessantly repeated horrific stories of the Holocaust can only serve to heighten the suspicions of the average Jew toward Gentiles while underscoring the need for Jewish solidarity among Jews. Modern Jewish supremacism. As I read more and more of the historical accounts of Jewish ethnocentrism, I wondered how much this applied to the modern-day Jews. I began to devour modern Jewish books and publications. I chose their most popular and respected newspapers, books, and magazines. Because I was now beginning to see a double standard, I began to look for corroborating evidence, and what I found fascinated me. In fact, finding it was easy, and it still is. Prominent Jews still proudly write and publish articles about their suspicion and condemnation of Gentiles. They boast of Jewish moral, spiritual, and genetic superiority. Even admissions of control over key positions in media and government in Gentile nations are in their contemporary literature. Any reader of publications meant for Jewish consumption will find material no less anti-Gentile than the 1,500-year-old Talmudic writ I quoted. It is seldom as brazen as the old material, but the underlying themes are inevitably present, and sometimes even unvarnished hatred just spills out. Many examples of what I'm talking about can be found in the largest Jewish newspaper outside of Israel, the Jewish Press, which sets the tone of Jewish religious and cultural attitudes more than any other newspaper. One of its primary religious authorities is Rabbi Simcha Cohen, who has an instructional Dear Abby type of column called Halakhic Questions. Not long ago, Rabbi Cohen instructed his readers that the Talmud denotes Gentiles as, quote, animals, as outlined by Talmudic writings from Gemara, Kedushin 68a, and Metziah 114b. In another section, he discusses how a Jewish woman is not designated as a prostitute if she has premarital sex with a Jew, but she is a whore if she has any sexual relations with a Gentile, even if she's married to him. Marriage to a Gentile can never be sanctified or condoned. This is a quote from his article. Such a liaison classifies the woman as a zona. Common parlance interprets the term zona to refer to prostitute. Indeed, premarital sex of a Jewish woman to a Jewish man does not automatically brand the woman as a zona. A Jewish woman becomes a prostitute or a zona in the eyes of the Talmud only when she marries or otherwise has sexual relations with a non-Jew. Another major Jewish publication, the Jewish Chronicle, in an article called Some Carefully and Carelessly Chosen Words, revealed that the Jewish term for Gentile woman is the offensive Yiddish word shiksa, meaning whore, from the Hebrew root shigetz, abomination. It also pointed out that a little Jewish girl is called shikselba, meaning little female abomination. Now, how would Jews react if Gentiles casually referred to Jewish women and Jewish little girls as whores and little whores? Moreover, not only Christians, but also non-Christians of all races are regarded as supernal refuse by Talmud teachers, such as the founder of Chabad Lubavitch, Rabbi Schneer Zalman. The Chabad is a powerful movement within Hasidim. The New Republic magazine, which has a mostly Jewish staff, had some revealing admissions in a May 1992 edition. There are some powerful ironies in Chabad's new messianic universalism and its mission to the Gentiles, and certainly the most unpleasant of them concerns Chabad's otherwise undisguised and even racial contempt for the Goyim. As for the Goyim, Zalman's attitude was Gentile souls are of a completely different and inferior order. They are totally evil, with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Consequently, references to Gentiles in Rabbi Schneer Zalman's teachings are invariably invidious. Their non-Jews' material abundance derives from supernal refuse. Indeed, they themselves derive from refuse, which is why there are more numerous Gentiles than Jews. As the pieces of chaff outnumber the kernels, all Jews were innately good, all Gentiles innately evil. Moreover, this characterization of Gentiles as being inherently evil, as being spiritually as well as biologically inferior to Jews, has not in any way been revised in later Chabad writing. That's directly from the New Republic. And recently, the Chabad has been doing teachings, and there's been ceremonies of the Chabad, including the most recent Chabad Rebbe, the Great Rebbe, in the White House itself, the White House of the United States. Now, it's true that all Jews do not have the extreme views of the Chabad, who are an integral part of the Jewish Orthodox religion. However, imagine if a movement existed within the Catholic or Methodist Church claiming that Jews or blacks are pieces of garbage and totally evil and have no redeeming qualities, that they're not even human beings. Would there not be a great outcry? The Jews have demanded that the Catholic Church take out of their liturgy anything that Jews deem as offensive, and the Catholics, as well as other Christian denominations, have done so. Yet, no one dares to insist that the Jewish faith should expunge references to Gentiles as, quote, innately evil with inferior souls, unquote. As I began to look at these issues from a new perspective, I saw that Judaism is centered in the preservation of Jewish heritage and the advancement of Jewish interests. In examining some of the encyclopedias and biographical reference works compiled by rabbinical authorities, I found prominent Jews listed who were self-proclaimed atheists and communists, as mentioned in the last chapter. Leon Trotsky, one of the main atheist perpetrators of the Russian Revolution, and Herbert Aptheker, the atheist chief theoretician of the Communist Party USA, are proudly listed in Jewish directories such as Who's Who in World Jewry and Who's Who in American Jewry. These books are compiled by the leading rabbinical organizations of America. The Jewish religion, as codified by the Talmud, is less concerned with an afterlife than with the survival and power of the Jewish people. Driven by the belief that Jews are the chosen people, Judaism is held together by chronic recitals of past persecutions. In a world that renounces racism, Judaism is the only creed on earth being praised for fostering genetic exclusion, elitism, ethnocentrism, and supremacism. Modern Israel is the only Western state that's openly theocratic, unashamedly proclaiming itself to be a nation whose purpose is to advance one religion and one unique people. Israel defines Judaism as the state religion with little separation of church and state in its civil and religious laws. In spite of their religious state, most Jews in Israel identify themselves as secular. But even the non-religious Jews of Israel and America support the Orthodox-run state of Israel, and they support numerous organizations run by Orthodox Jews around the world. They support it as a mechanism for preserving their cultural and racial heritage. Most of us never see the reality of Jewish chauvinism and power, because we have not organized the scattered facts into a coherent whole. Like a child's connect-the-dot puzzle, most of us have not yet connected the dots and completed the picture. The media erase as many dots as they can from our awareness, and anyone who succeeds in connecting all the dots is bludgeoned back with the ultimate moral weapon, accusations of anti-Semitism. Given the Jewish influences that have so much power in this nation's media and finance, it is amazing that any Gentiles would dare oppose them. Once accused of being an anti-Semite, one faces an intractable enemy organized around the world, one that will do whatever it takes to discredit, intimidate, jail, and destroy him. After I completed a survey of readings in the Talmud and of the modern Zionist writers, I realized that the Europeans were not the only historical practitioners of racial and religious intolerance. Actually, the Jews have been quite proficient at it themselves. Once I accepted that Jewish ethnocentrism existed, again I asked the question. The question that had arose after my enlightenment on the, quote, Russian Revolution. Why were we forbidden to know this? A Jew can rightly object to slanderous criticism from Christians. Why should I, as a Christian, not be upset by slanderous criticism of my heritage by Jews? If Christians are wrong to voice hateful sentiments against Jews, why are not Jews just as reprehensible for voicing hateful sentiments against Christians? Are the media right in suggesting that Christians have a monopoly on hate, while Jews have a monopoly on charity? Which religion, as judged by the evidence of its own writings, is more motivated by hatred? Even as I write these provocative words, I harbor no hatred toward the Jewish people. There are intolerant Jews just as there are intolerant Gentiles. It's also true that there are many Jews who respect our Christian heritage. But unless the non-chauvinist Jews are willing to work hard to bring to their own faith and community the same kind of love and reconciliation that Christ taught, the cycle of hatred between Jew and Gentile could fester. Unless they temper their supremacism with acceptance and love, they could suffer a replay of the terrible excesses of the past. The government, church, and media establishment work zealously to diminish Gentile intolerance of Jews. That objective can be realized only through an equal effort to lessen Jewish chauvinism, suspicion, and anger against Gentiles. As the Israeli human rights activist Israel Shahak wrote, anti-Semitism and Jewish chauvinism can only be fought simultaneously. After reading the words of Zionism's modern founder, Theodor Herzl, I fully realize that there are, as he expressed it, alien power brokers in our civilization. These are people who do not share our culture, our traditions, our faith, our interests, or our values. I realize that if I desire to preserve the heritage and values of my people, I would have to defend my people from the intolerant sector within the Jewish community that seeks domination rather than reconciliation. When I was 16, I never suspected that just by pointing out the powerful Jewish elements of anti-Gentilism, I would be labeled anti-Semitic. I do not accept that label today. And I still believe that it is no more anti-Semitic to oppose Jewish supremacism than it is anti-Italian to oppose the mafia. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed the final part of the second chapter, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. I hope all of you will spread this book and the spoken version to your friends and your family. And don't forget the published version, the hardcover, well-footnoted version is available. Parts of the book are available on the Internet for your reading, but most of the book must be purchased in hardback form. And all the documents are there, so you can listen to this and follow along with the documents if you like. I think this book offers a short education into what's really happening. I'm glad you're with me today, and don't forget that tomorrow I'll continue with the first part of chapter 3, a very interesting chapter entitled Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Thanks for being with me. I'll see you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.